it was an unknown wilderness. It wasn't long before they went into the wide valleys of Kentucky, through the Cumberland Gap.
Welcome to this edition of Old Kentucky Tales, the only podcast that solemnly swears that none of its participants have ever worn a brown suit on a week-to-week basis. Today's title is Rupp, the second most famous Adolf in history. I am your host, Brent Taylor, Assistant Professor of History at West Kentucky Community and Technical College, and with me is the man who only chatters when it really matters. He is an Associate Professor of Communication at West Kentucky Community and Technical College, Jason Donner.
Does it really matter right now?
Of course it matters.
Right? Okay.
All right. With us today is a very special guest, a man who possesses more audio tapes than the Nixon administration, Dwayne Bolin. And that's true, right? Dwayne, I saw a box of oral interview tapes regarding Rupp near your office that was just amazing.
About 20 years ago, my professor at the University of Kentucky, Dr. Humbert Nelly, had researched Rupp for about 15 years himself, and he had interviewed at least one player from every one of Rupp's teams from 1930 to 1972, a collection of over 100 taped interviews. He had decided not to complete a biography of Rupp, so he gave me the collection of his research on Rupp, which included that 100 taped interviews with Rupp's former players, assistant coaches, UK presidents, politicians, on and on. So this is a unique collection that he had given me over 20 years ago. So yes, I have this unique collection of tape after tape after tape. And that's what I use as the basis for my biography of Adolf Rupp.
Yeah, it really is an amazing collection. I just couldn't believe it when I saw it. In this episode of Old Kentucky Tales, our main event, we'll discuss the winningest coach in Kentucky history, Adolf Rupp. And along the way, don't forget to support the fake history sponsors who support Old Kentucky Tales. The products are real, only the sponsorship is fake.
Cairo. Give your children Cairo and sliced bread. It takes the place of candy. Satisfies nature's craving for sweets.
Give them all they want.
It means more health and strength.
So then,
I'd forgotten about this stuff. This was sometimes on the shelf, and there was no real syrup there, and it was terrible. Hated this stuff. And your mom would pull out that Cairo. You know what I mean? It was there. Maybe it's just a South thing.
I never had to eat it myself.
Oh, well.
The only thing I've actually put this in is bubble solution.
It was clear, if I remember right. It was not good. It was barely a flavor.
And here they're saying it's a dessert substitute.
Yeah, that's just my memory. I'd forgot. I'd blocked all this Cairo out. But now, you know, no, there's no syrup, so you got to eat this stuff.
So what about you, Dwayne? Did your parents ever try to slip a non-dessert past you as a dessert?
No, I remember Cairo syrup. I remember that well. Yes, yes.
That jar, that clear jar, and it was just like, what is that, glue?
Glue might have had a little more taste, Jason.
Exactly. And I'd had glue before. This is when I was a little kid. Go ahead.
Oh.
Well, I thought you had a little something.
Oh, right. That's true. That's true. I found another clip from a past episode, I forget which, where, I don't know, we just sounded a little different, sounded not like quite ourselves.
I don't believe that, but let's hear it.
Okay.
Rosemary, dried celery leaves, carrots, onions, potato, one
kidney
cup
stew.
Each.
Yeah. I guess, though, like you said, we're rationing, so we're down to the entrails of the cow.
We are, and a lot of those entrails are non-rationed. So you can actually get as
well,
many
of course.
As you want.
Uh, I can get all the kidneys I can stand. Give me that pancreas.
All you care to eat, pancreas?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. You get a cup of fine breadcrumbs, some poultry seasoning, a small onion, salt and pepper to taste, flour for dredging, and fat for browning.
The way you read these things, people might listen to this and go, I want to do that.
I want that recipe. A baked stuffed heart this afternoon.
You're selling it.
Yeah.
Flour for dredging. That's what I do.
Oh my God. Thank God it's over.
That was the longest long lunch of all time.
I don't remember
right?
it being that long that I made that thing. I feel a little stupid now and embarrassed that we're sitting here with your college professor and we're playing a clip like we're drunk.
Oh.
Silly.
Believe me, where Dr. Bowen comes from, drinking was not necessarily frowned upon. So I think he's heard a few conversations like that before.
Well,
down at the Apple.
It was, yeah, that's right. That Apple, you had to go south, as we called it. Right. I didn't mean to make that so long, but it was funny because of we were talking about entrails and such.
Adolf Ruff would have understood that completely. He grew up on a hardscrabble farm.
In
German Mennonite country. He was a German Mennonite from Halstead, Kansas, and grew up in the middle of the wheat fields of Kansas. So the question with Ruff was, how did a German Mennonite from a pacifist Mennonite sect become a cursing, curmudgeonly basketball coach in Kentucky?
That's kind of a strange journey.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought.
A very strange journey.
And that is the perfect segue for the moment we've all been waiting for.
The main event.
Round one. Now, Dwayne, you have a brand new book out. Tell us about this book.
Well, the name of the book is Adolf Rupp and the Rise of Kentucky Basketball. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky, just hot off the press. And it's really 20 years in the making. I've been researching and writing it for a long time. I think my wife and children are happier that it's out than I am.
But that's right. Rupp kind of moved into your spare bedroom, right?
Yes, he did. But my professor gave me the materials, and I felt beholden to complete the biography that he had started. But Rupp was a very colorful character, and one of the main points that I wanted to make in the book was that certainly Adolf Rupp changed the state of Kentucky, but the state of Kentucky changed Adolf Rupp as well.
And I didn't know that it was finishing a book from the work from your previous professor.
Yes, I think he had gotten sort of fed up with Adolf. Adolf was a very egotistical person. The matter, you know, I think a lot of people think of, especially critics of Adolf, equate Adolf with the question of race, but he was a much more complicated person than that. He was a very superstitious person. He did things the same way before every game, put on one sock on his left foot, put on the other sock on his right foot. He always looked for hairpins in the parking lot. If he found a hairpin, he knew he was going to win by 30 points. He went into the urinal in the locker room at halftime, and one time he went into the urinal with his son, Herky. Herky was about 8 years. Well, maybe younger than that, and all of a sudden the players sitting in the locker room waiting for his usual halftime tirade heard Adolf, their coach, say, "You're peeing on my leg, damn it, Herky! quit peeing on my leg." But But he was a character, a colorful character, great with the press, and he always held his post-game interview in his hotel room. He would come out in his red silk pajamas, and he would order one of his ball boys to have Löwenbräu beer. It was always, that was part of, I guess, part of his German heritage. But he would order his ball boys to have Löwenbräu beer and White Castle hamburgers for the press. And they would gather in his hotel room, and only bourbon would do for the Baron. So he would get a bourbon and fill it half full in the glass, and then go back to the bathroom and just a little spritz of water, and then he would come back in and take a big drink, and you could see the tears come into his eyes, and then he would say, "All right, boys," he said, "there's White Castles there." There's beer for you now. Ask your questions. Let's have our press conference. And that's the way they'd have their press conference after the game.
Got to be a popular thing, right?
Yeah, sure.
Show up and get a burger. Plus,
well,
you're doing your job.
It helps to be just fun like that, you know, that he enjoyed it.
He's probably, you know, he would probably have beaten the team by 30 points, but he would always praise the opposing coach because he wanted the coach to be back next year. He wanted them to be praised in the press so that the opposing coach would be back next year so he could beat them again.
That's funny.
Yeah,
that was a
these
tough
guys,
fight.
These guys aren't they, really adorable.
We need a rematch.
I mean, yeah.
Most of the opposing coaches, you know, in the Southeastern Conference were assistant football coaches. They didn't take basketball that seriously in the Southeastern Conference. It was a football conference until he really made them take basketball seriously.
And that makes sense. If you think about some of the teams in the SEC today, it's still football-oriented. Not all of them, of course, but many of them.
Yeah.
You think about Alabama, the basketball, generally an afterthought, or a Georgia, that they're definitely serious about football.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I think Adolph is the one that made them stand up and take basketball more seriously. Yes.
I think that's exactly right, because we know he is one of the transformative coaches. When you look at the record, finishing as the all-time leader in wins, things like, I mean, that's a very serious kind of record of success.
He ended with a record of 876 victories, 190 defeats. Now, that's been surpassed now by Coach K and well, if you look at women's basketball, by Pat Summitt at Tennessee. But when he retired from the game, he had more wins than any other college coach.
Yeah, and that's really kind of the mark. I mean, there's always somebody later who will come along and do that sort of thing. But when you retire number one,
mm-hmm. right,
that's the pinnacle. And he had this mystique about him, right? So he built a mystique on purpose. Is that right?
That's right. I think he used that German background. He called himself the Baron. You know, there was one game when he was coaching at Freeport High School in the years before he came to Kentucky where he bought a brand new blue suit, and he lost the game where he wore the blue suit, so he went back to wearing the old brown suit. And so from then on, he was the man in the brown suit and wore brown suits from there on out.
That is superstitious, right? Like the color of something or what you saw on the way. And sports is superstitious.
Of course.
I mean, baseball players especially are kind of like that. You don't hear about it quite as much in basketball, but you can definitely see that he's from that sports cloth.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's like a joke in the just kind of in society that, you know, you see everybody do that. They wear the same dirty socks, you know, that kind of thing. You mentioned earlier about him, you know, surprising where he came from to where he ended up. Give us a little bit about his early life that he ended up a coach at all.
His parents moved to Halstead, Kansas from Europe and grew up growing wheat, turkey red wheat in the wheat fields of Kansas. He grew up. His father died when Adolf was 11 years old. He didn't speak English until he was 6 years old. And he went to German school there in Halstead. And then after he graduated from Halstead High School, he went to the University of Kansas and played for legendary coach Fog Allen. The inventor of the game of basketball, James Naismith, was his PE teacher at the University of Kansas.
Okay.
So he had a pretty good pedigree, although he never scored a point at Kansas. He was always on the reserve team at Kansas. But he learned basketball from Fog Allen and from James Naismith there at Kansas. Then he coached at Burr Oak High School. And then was a wrestling coach at Marshalltown in Iowa. And then at Freeport High School, he coached for three seasons before coming to Kentucky in 1930.
Okay. Right. That's interesting that he actually was, he knew and was coached by the guy that invented basketball.
That's right.
That's a little predictive too,
yeah.
I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Who knows? Who knows basketball better than Naismith?
I mean, well,
that's the thing, right?
It's a famous name for sure, of course.
And by the way, Naismith was the head coach at University of Kansas and the only losing coach in Kansas's history.
Oh. Beaten at his own game. That's what you call that.
Oh, come on. Now, that was good. You're in good shape. They say they, like, you know, they put that basket up there, but they didn't put the hole in the basket
for a while.
Like, I would think immediately.
You had to go fish it out.
The second time, you're like, let's just cut a hole. Yeah. But they say, anyway, that's the way I've heard it.
Yes.
They waited, you know, it was like a couple years before they did that.
Yeah. It was invented in Springfield, Massachusetts in 1891, and he saw it more as just a game to keep in shape during the winter months,
right,
as an alternative to football.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cage team. They used to call it the cage team for some reason.
What do you mean?
It was indoors, and that was just a nickname for it.
Oh, okay.
They would put a cage around the court, I guess to keep rabid fans out off the court.
Okay. Right.
That's like an old cage school match terminology on that one. And really, he's more than just a Kentucky coach, too, because he had the Olympic team.
He
had some experience.
He won in 1948, the London Olympics. He was the assistant coach in London, and he really was proud of that because he put that on his tombstone in the Lexington Cemetery.
Right.
Oh, his tombstone's interesting all by itself. Could you describe that to people who've never seen it?
It's white granite and white marble, rather, and has a basketball at the top of the. Never mentions that he coached in Kentucky, but he was proud that he was in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, and that he won the 1948 Olympics. He was proud of those things more than anything else.
Yeah, because that's an international competition, and that's best of the best.
Yeah. If you get to be the coach for that, from that country. I want to ask you about the book a little bit more, too, though, because you came into it, I know, with all this knowledge before you decide, I'm going to write a book or finish a book. Anything you discovered that you didn't expect to be the case with Adolf Rupp?
Well, you know, the question of race was on my mind throughout the book. I was surprised that in the early 1960s, he recruited two African-American athletes to come to Kentucky in the early 60s. But then when he got so much flack from Kentucky fans, he backed off that and decided not to recruit them after all. So it wasn't until the very end of his coaching career that he recruited one black athlete, Tom Payne, who played 1 year for Kentucky, before he was drafted as a hardship case with the Atlanta Hawks. So that was a surprise to me that it was really some backlash that he got from fans back home in Lexington. And Tom Payne said that there was some abuse that he got back when he played at home in Lexington was just as harsh as some of the abuse that he got on the road down in Starkville, Mississippi, or Oxford, Mississippi.
Right.
Lexington was a southern city, you know, and that was a big turning point to have black players play in Lexington for the University of Kentucky Wildcats.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I've seen also in that period, a lot of the players didn't want to be the first.
They didn't want to
be that pioneer because it was hard.
Perry Wallace was that pioneer, you know, when he played for Vanderbilt. And he was a real hero in that and being the first in the Southeastern Conference. Andrew Marinus has written a fine book called Strong Inside about the Perry Wallace journey as being the first African-American basketball player in the Southeastern Conference.
Yeah, that was definitely a great story. And sounds like we got a lot of great stories in here. 400 pages worth, right?
Over 400 pages. There's a selection of photographs in the middle that puts it over the 400-page mark. Yes.
I've got kind of a loaded question here, just to end it with about Adolph Rupp. But we had a lot of good coaches in Kentucky. Would you put him at the top in terms of coaching? Where would you put him in there?
Yeah. Well, you know, he did not. He certainly was a great coach. There's no doubt about that. But he was not the first great coach in Kentucky basketball history. The coach before him, Johnny Meyer, had a record of 40-14 with a record of 16-3 the year before Rupp came in 1930. So that tradition of excellence in Kentucky basketball was already well in place before Rupp came. But Rupp certainly extended that. He won four national championships, one NIT national championship, several Sugar Bowl championships. I think 26 or 27 SEC championships. So there's no doubt about the greatness that he established in Kentucky basketball while he was coaching for 42 years.
And you know what we got to do now, Jason? We got to pay some bills around here.
Oh, I could sense it. could sense it was coming.
Yep. We can't leave the sponsors out of this. This portion is brought to us by Dick Smiley, Volkswagen, Porsche, Audi. 41.4 miles per gallon. Mr. Reese Smith, using techniques to maximize economy, drove a Porsche 914, which he bought from Smiley, with a 1.8-liter engine. From Elizabethtown, Kentucky to Paducah, Kentucky, a distance of 199 miles, using 4.8 gallons of gas, which, if you do your math out there, equals 41.4 miles per gallon. If you are interested in gas mileage and quality, see any of the salespeople at Dick Smiley, 2101 South Beltline. That comes to us fresh from the 1974 energy crisis, Jason.
Sure. Okay. Is he in Paducah?
Yeah.
Is that what this is?
Yeah.
Or Elizabethtown? Okay.
That is Paducah.
It's funny that we have a Porsche dealer even. Do you say Porsche? I say Porsche.
Yeah.
Some people
I
say
think
Porsche.
The enthusiasts always say Porsche.
Yeah, it gets
how
on
do
my
you
nerves.
Play it, Dwayne?
I say Porsche.
I do too. That's how they said it on TV when I was growing up. So, you know, he drove a Porsche.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. He's got the good cars.
He's got the car that'll get you 40 miles to the gallon plus
in 1974. He didn't invent the car, though. He didn't build it. He just sells them.
Yeah, well, that's all that matters.
Think Smiley's his real name, though?
I was wondering about that because—
That's a memorable name.
I'm thinking maybe he got done with a B-movie career and thought, well, what do I do next? I'll just sell cars.
Okay. Or vice versa. Sure.
But I could be wrong. That's just a theory. Just a theory. And now—
Oh,
speaking of theories, I got a theory that you're not going to like this, and it is what you learned today, Jason. What is your takeaway?
Oh, boy. A lot of pressure on me here not to be superficial about it with our guest and everything. But, like, okay, I like to go back into my own memories. You know, what do you think of with Adolph Rupp? I mean, that name even, like, permeated my childhood. Rupp Arena, Rupp Arena, Rupp Arena, all through the 80s. Just watching those games during that time. He's like the standard. Like, he's like the gold standard of basketball. And some people just end up that way from everything they did, but, like, personality-wise, too. We've got a few, I guess, outlandish type coach characters, but those are the ones that tend to be great, or we remember them forever.
Yeah, that's definitely him. I mean,
right?
It's not just the record and all that stuff. It's the persona.
Yeah, it's personality.
And the mystique and the whole thing. And we can definitely find out more about that in the new book,
yeah.
Adolph Rupp and the Rise of Kentucky Basketball.
Where do we get the book?
Well, you can order it from Amazon.com or from the University Press of Kentucky site at KentuckyPress.com.
Okay.
There'll be some book signings coming up, one in Murray at Polk Library, and I'll be speaking at Kentucky Ups at evenings upstairs at the McCracken County Public Library.
All right, excellent. We have now turned to the final page of this chapter, but never fear, Old Kentucky Tales never fails to return. I don't know why, it just keeps coming back. You can download even more episodes on iTunes or the NPR One app. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or rate us. If you did not like what you heard, there is no way you are here at minute 26. Special thanks to our producer, Todd Birdsong, our guest, Dwayne Bolin, the Paducah School of Art and Design, WKCTC, a really great place to learn some stuff,
mm-hmm.
and WKMS. And the rest is history.